I believe that Blood Meridian is primarily concerned with evil, and not only the moral evil of human beings, which is obvious in the actions of the Glanton Gang, but also the so-called natural evil of the world itself. And this paper will chiefly be concerned with the latter. So despite the specific setting, the southwest of the American southwest of the 1850s, the novel possesses a kind of timeless quality, which it's chiefly a metaphysical novel rather than a historical one, for me anyway, because I think it presents the problem of evil as something eternal and universal rather than specific to that wild west of the 1850s. I think in Blood Meridian, and in a lot of his other novels too, McCarthy presents the reader with an anti-cosmic or world-rejecting attitude towards existence and creation. And this is readily apparent in the novel's nightmarish landscapes and skyscapes. So Sam Smith defines the anti-cosmic position as a belief that material creation is inherently flawed and thus cannot be made suitable for any ideal purpose. Conversely, the pro-cosmic position is that the natural world as created for, sorry, the pro-cosmic position views the natural world as created for and suited to the fulfillment of the eternal promises and purposes of God for man. Now, the anti-cosmic position occurs in a few religions, but it's most overt and most obvious in Gnosticism, which was is known as a heresy, but really it was a major religion in its time in Manichaeanism, which for a while was on par with Christianity and Islam and Buddhism as a major world religion. And it was a system of belief which emerged alongside Christianity between the 1st and 3rd centuries AD. It was very syncretic. It took on a lot of influences from Christianity, but also the Hellenic religions, paganism, Babylonian influences, Egyptian, Iranian, Jewish, even Eastern traditions of Buddhism and Hinduism came in through the Silk Road, through Egypt, and were integrated. The Gnostics basically believed, in a nutshell, that the world was created by an inferior and possibly malevolent deity that they called a demiurge, like Plato's demiurge, except malevolent. And they believed in a god, that they said there was a true god, but it was more of a transcendent entity, rather like Plato's absolute, and had nothing whatsoever to do with creation or with ruling over the world. It was wholly other. So according to Gnosticism, the bodies and psyches, like the mental life of human beings, belong to the demiurge, but there's also a spirit, or pneuma, which is like a spark of divinity trapped within matter, which is also trapped within human beings, and this doesn't belong here. There are various really complicated myths about how the spark got trapped in matter in the first place, but it will take a whole lecture just to explore a few of those, so I'm not going to get into it. But the point is that there's this spark of goodness that doesn't belong here that's trapped in the physical realm. To summarize, Gnostic scholar Kurt Rudolph explains that earthly material existence, like the world itself, is a product of the demiurge and correspondingly is a sphere hostile to the alien god. That's what they call the true god, the other god, and that the world is dominated by evil powers. Conversely, we find the pro-cosmic view in traditional Christianity, which believes that God created the world for man, but even there, it's sort of mitigated by the fact that humanity is supposedly cast out of Eden and sent into the world as punishment. So even in Christianity, the world is not entirely friendly to us. The narrative voice in Blood Meridian is markedly anti-cosmic throughout, referring to the landscape as a terra damnata of smoking slag, a godless quadrant cold and sterile, a purgatorial waste where nothing moves save carnivorous birds, a country where the rocks would cook the flesh from your hands and where other than rock nothing was. Journeys only take travelers into a land more hostile yet. The landscape in Blood Meridian, as a few scholars have pointed out, evokes the imagery of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, most notably in the passage that describes how the rock trembled and sleared in the sun, rock and no water and the sandy trace, and they kept watch for any green thing that might tell of water, but there was not water. This is clearly an allusion to what the thunder said, which goes, here is no water but only rock, rock and no water and the sandy road. And as in The Wasteland, the landscape in Blood Meridian is a outward projection, a symbolic projection of spiritual desolation. One of the most obscure the more obscure allusions to the hostility of the created world is evoked through a passage that describes Glanton's gang sleeping with their alien hearts beating in the sand like pilgrims exhausted upon the face of the planet Adaretta, clutched to a nameless wheeling in the night. Now, Leo Doherty, who first drew my attention to the Gnostic motifs in McCarthy's work, interprets the passage in the following way. Anaretta was believed in the Renaissance to be the planet which destroys life, and violent deaths are caused when the malefics have agents in the anaretic place. This is from the OED definition of anaretta. So the implication is that our own Earth is anaretic. And McCarthy's descriptions of malevolent landscapes and skyscapes in which death seems the most prevalent feature can thus be read as Gnostic portrayals of a nightmarish anaretic world. Even this, as we discussed during an earlier session, this Blood Meridian is not just the landscape, it's also the sky, it's the cosmos, it extends upwards. And the sun is a particularly powerful symbol throughout Blood Meridian, even in the title it's there. It's and I think this is portrayed in a distinctly anti-cosmic Gnostic fashion. The sun signifies death and violence. Normally, the sun is a symbol of renewal and spiritual illumination for most traditions, but in Blood Meridian, it's the opposite. It's death and destruction and malice. So McCarthy's trademark blood-red sunsets abound in Blood Meridian, and there's a very clear association between the sun and bloodshed. The sun is portrayed in a very defamiliarizing way. For example, it's described as the color of steel, which is immediately strengthens this association between weapons, weaponry, and violence. But also, it's cold. Steel is cold. You know, to describe the sun as steel is it's so different to what you'd expect. And there's the revolting urine-colored sun. It's described as urine-colored also. It rises blearily through panes of dust on a dim world. These are distinctly unsettling images, and they go against what we've become accustomed to in literature about this is not how the sun is normally portrayed. The most startling solar imagery is the one that's often quoted. The top of the sun rose out of nothing like the head of a great red phallus until it cleared the unseen rim and sat squat and pulsing and malevolent behind them. Now, this is an amazing description of the sun. And in the course of my reading, I came across a passage in Jung, which I think McCarthy might have read, because we know McCarthy has quite strong Jungian influences in his work. And Jung tells of a schizophrenic patient who said he could see an erect phallus on the sun. When he moved his head from side to side, he said the sun's phallus moved with it, and that was where the wind came from. Now, Jung traced this back to a Mithraic, to a liturgy of the Mithraic religion. The cult of Mithras was another major religion of ancient Rome, and a mystery cult. So the original Mithraic text reads, "And likewise the so-called tube, the origin of the ministering wind, for you will see hanging down from the disk of the sun something that looks like a tube." The likelihood of the Jungian influence is compounded by the fact that later in the novel, the narrative voice describes how a wind was blowing out of the sun where it sat squat and pulsing at the eastern reaches of the earth. So there's very clear similarities between Blood Meridian's phallic sun and the Mithraic phallus solaris. So I think it's quite deliberate because McCarthy's usage of the words squat and pulsing occurs in both instances, and there's a sort of conscious linking of these two passages. As I said, in Blood Meridian, McCarthy inverts the traditional life-giving symbolism of the sun, and like even the image of the phallus is life-giving, it's procreation, but he inverts it and he turns it into something like a symbol of cosmic malevolence. It's noteworthy that in this inversion of a concept upheld by Platonists and Neoplatonist philosophers of classical antiquity, for them the sun was a visible manifestation of the good, of the absolute, and McCarthy follows in the subversive footsteps of the Gnostics by inverting this. So Hans Jonas, who's a famous Gnostic scholar, explains that Gnostic dualism comes as a new principle of meaning, appropriates the elements which it can use for its purposes, and subjects them to a radical reinterpretation. So whereas for the classical mind, for Plato, for Neoplatonists, for Plotinus, the seven heavenly spheres, namely the sun, the moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Jupiter, and Saturn, had represented the divinity of the cosmos at its purest, for the Gnostics, they now became symbols of something that separated them from the divine. So Gnosticism saw the heavenly spheres as enclosing the created world, making it a prison for those particles of divinity which had become entrapped in the system. For the Gnostics, the heavenly spheres became a symbol of oppression, representing the barriers that surround the earth and keep the divine human spirit imprisoned within the manifest realm of matter. Hans Jonas explains that even in antiquity, the sun already, for the pagan nature worshippers, the sun was already rather ambivalent. It occupied a many-faceted position, being at the same time the god which dispenses light, warmth, life, growth, who victoriously rises out of night, puts to flight the winter and renews nature, but who also brings scorching pestilence and death. The sun in Blood Meridian has been reduced to these wholly negative components. The sun brings pestilence in the form of a heliotropic plague of gold seekers, itinerant degenerates bleeding westward, who seem to be under the maleficent influence of the sun. Pestilence is also evoked through the image of the men who watched each day for that thing to gather itself out of its terrible incubation in the house of the sun, and whether it be armies or plague or pestilence or something altogether unspeakable, they waited with a strange equanimity. So the concept of the sun bringing disease is emphasized not only through the direct references to plague and pestilence, but also through the oblique reference to incubation, as though the sun were harboring some sort of, or hatching some sort of bacterial menace, like a petri dish. You know, the idea that the sun may bring something altogether unspeakable is emphasized throughout the novel. When the Glanton gang abandon a murdered Apache in the desert, they leave him to scrutinize with his dying eyes the calamitous advance of the sun, as though the progression of the sun across the sky marked the progress of some terrible catastrophe. And we get this throughout the novel. Again, as the sun goes across the sky, there's a sense of malice. It's bringing evil and death and suffering. There's none of the usual connotations of illumination and life and regeneration. It's always death, bloodshed, violence, scorching, disease. The sunset, the imagery of disaster and chaos is further developed in a passage that describes the sunset as the red demise of that day and the distant pandemonium of the sun. The sun in Blood Meridian is a sort of merciless devourer. It's wandering in the desert, men with burnt-out eyes grow gaunted and lank under the white-hot suns of those days until they appear like beings for whom the sun hungered. Its indifference to human beings is made apparent in its ability to wipe out all trace of their violent deaths. In the days to come, the frail black rebuses of blood in those sands will crack and break and drift away, so that in a circuit of a few suns, all trace of the destruction of these people would be erased, and there will be nothing, nor ghost nor scribe, to tell to any pilgrim in his passing how it was that people had lived in this place and in this place died. The sun is again a bringer of death, not life. Such a description of a celestial body usually associated with the life-giving properties of light and warmth suggests that in McCarthy's narrative, the Gnostic horror of existence extends well beyond our planet and includes the entire cosmos in its negative anti-cosmic evaluation. The Glanton gang stumbles across the remains of a group of scalped travelers, again described as right pilgrims nameless among the stones with their terrible wounds. Blood Meridian is replete with pilgrims who never find their way to any kind of god and whose journeys lead straight to death. The word pilgrims is used over and over again. The dead in their wigs of dried blood lie gazing up with ape's eyes at brother sun now rising in the east. Here, brother sun is an allusion, a chillingly sarcastic allusion to St. Francis of Assisi's Canticle of the Sun, which reads, "We praise it, O my Lord, by all thy creatures, and chiefly by Monsignor brother sun, whom in the day thou lightenest for us, for fair is he and radiant with resplendence, and of thee most high beareth he the semblance." So the last two lines are most telling, because, and McCarthy's implications are clear, if the sun bears the likeness of the creator god, then what terrible things can we deduce about the deity's nature by examining the sun in Blood Meridian? In keeping with this Gnostic proclivity for theological subversion, McCarthy's portrayals of the sun invert not only classical philosophies, but also Christian teachings. It's just subversive throughout. In Blood Meridian, as in Gnostic thought, the heavenly spheres are regarded as symbols of evil, as I've already mentioned. Hans Jonas describes the Gnostic view of the cosmos in great detail. He says, "We can imagine with what feelings Gnostic men must have looked up to the starry sky, how evil its brilliance must have looked to them, how alarming its vastness and the rigid immutability of its courses, how cruel its muteness. The music of the spheres was no longer heard, and the admiration for the perfect spherical form gave place to the terror of so much perfection directed at the enslavement of man. The pious wonderment with which earlier man had looked up to the higher regions of the universe became a feeling of oppression by the iron vault which keeps man exiled from his home beyond. Blood Meridian features numerous references to the starry sky, all of which are marked by a sense of dismay, fear, or loneliness. We have, the night sky lies so spent with stars that there is scarcely space of black at all, and they fall all night in bitter arcs, and it is so that their numbers are no less. Such descriptions evoke a sense of oppressive eternity, because no matter how many stars fall in their bitter arcs, their numbers are never lessened, it just goes on forever. The oppressive quality of the cosmos is emphasized further when the stars are described as burning with a lidless fixity, as though they were unblinking eyes, fixed upon the world below in unceasing surveillance. Now, we mentioned this in an earlier paper, that there seems to be a sort of all-seeing eye in the sky in Blood Meridian, watching the action and unblinking, remorseless. It's the narrative perspective, but it's also a sort of malevolent entity that just doesn't care. Even the constellation of Cassiopeia evokes a sense of cosmic malice. It's burning like a witch's signature on the black face of the firmament. It's almost like the demiurge had signed his creation, you know, like an artist. The night sky is full of evil omens. There's a pale green meteor that passed overhead and vanished silently into the void. There's falling stars throughout. There's all kinds of omens and harbingers of death and violence occur in the sky throughout. There's much like the French mathematician and mystic Blaise Pascal, who wrote of the terrifying immensity of the universe which surrounds me, the Gnostics were dismayed by the spatial and temporal enormity of the cosmos, believing that the vastness and multiplicity of the cosmic system expresses the degree to which man is removed from the alien God. So the sense that the cosmos is huge and God is not in the cosmos, so the bigger it is, the further we are from God. So the night sky filled them with a sense of loneliness because they were so far removed from that sacred, from the true spark of divinity. Hans Jonas explains that the starry sky, which from Plato to the Stoics was the purest embodiment of reason in the cosmic hierarchy, and therefore the divine aspect of the sensible realm, became for the Gnostics the fixed glare of alien power and necessity. Furthermore, the night sky's vastness, power, and perfection of order no longer evoked contemplation and imitation, but aversion and revolt. The narrative voice in Blood Meridian frequently evokes the terrible enormity of the cosmos. The sun, when it rose, caught the moon in the west, so that they lay opposed to each other across the earth, the sun white-hot and the moon a pale replica, as if they were the ends of a common bore beyond whose terminals burned worlds past all reckoning. These words suggest not only that the universe extends forever outwards to infinite numbers of other worlds, but also suggest that the terrible infinitude extending inwards or downwards in a more metaphysical sense into the awful darkness inside the world, which is also the sort of heart of darkness inside man that you get in. You might remember the hermit holding up the blackened heart, and there's this reference to Conrad's heart of darkness there. So there's this apprehension of the terrible vastness and emptiness of the created world, and it's prevalent throughout McCarthy's work. You find it in the other novels too. It's just most striking in Blood Meridian. As many scholars have pointed out, Blood Meridian abounds, and I think John Sepage actually counted the instances of the word void, and he came with some large number, which I've forgotten. But Blood Meridian abounds in passages that evoke the terror of this void. There's descriptions of the vast world of sand and scrub shearing upward into the shoreless void and to the uttermost rebate of space. There are staccato mountains, bespoken blue and barren out of the void. There's the ribbed frames of dead cattle that lie like the ruins of primitive boats upturned upon that shoreless void. And it goes on. I could quote so many instances of void in Blood Meridian. Wandering lost through the wilderness, the kid contemplates a wounded companion, I think Sproul, and sees that he was wounded in an enemy country far from home, and although his eyes took in the alien stones about, yet the greater void beyond seemed to swallow up his soul. This is a very Gnostic passage. It evokes this terrible despair at the vastness of creation, and creation which is alien to us and which swallows up and imprisons the human spirit. It also emphasizes the Gnostic motive of alienation. The Gnostics were the first to really get into alienation before the existentialists, long before, because the whole basis of human existence for them was alienation. We don't belong here. the core of human life is alienation. And they taught that the divine spirit, this little spark of divinity trapped within us, is estranged among the alien stones of the created world. It doesn't belong here. It feels lost. It longs to return to its true home. There's also an allusion here to Keats's Ode to a Nightingale, where Ruth is described as standing in tears amid the alien corn. The idea that human beings are prisoners on Earth is alluded to many times in Blood Meridian. For example, when the Glanton Gang are referred to as a patrol condemned to ride out some ancient curse. Given the purgatorial wasteland that dominates the novel, this ancient curse seems to be existence itself. Elsewhere, the horses of the Glanton Gang are described as trudging sullenly the alien ground, while the round earth rolled beneath them, silently milling the greater void wherein they were contained. Even the horses are alien on Earth. Every living thing is alienated. So the passage not only emphasizes the alien nature of the created world, but also locates this alienation within the greater context of the enormity of the cosmos. Again, you've got that void and the terrible vastness of space. Coming on to one of the most frequently quoted passages, the narrative voice evokes this metaphysical complexity of the metaphysical complexity of this alienation in what's been known as the optical democracy passage, which many, many people have quoted and discussed. It reads, "In the neuter austerity of that terrain, all phenomena were bequeathed a strange equality, and no one thing, nor spider, nor stone, nor blade of grass, could put forth claim to precedence. The very clarity of these articles belie their familiarity, for the eye predicates the whole on some feature or part, and here was nothing more luminous than another, and nothing more enshadowed. And in the optical democracy of such landscape, all preference is made whimsical, and a man and a rock become endowed with unguessed kinship." There's been many readings of this in a kind of nihilistic reductionist view that reduces man and rock to the same level. The reader is presented with this reductionist vision in which inherent value and meaning have been leveled out, so it's no longer possible to say that human beings are in any way better than a spider or a blade of grass or even an inanimate object like a rock. But I argue that this strange equality is not to be mistaken for... There's an idea that in mysticism that all things are one, this kind of unity. And I don't think that this is being presented here. This strange equality is not to be mistaken for this transcendent state of unity, which have been described by various mystical traditions, in which all phenomena appear equally unreal or as manifestations of Maya, which is illusion. Fritjof Schuon, he's into the sort of transcendent unity of religions. He looks at a lot of religions and the similarities they have. He explains that the metaphysical doctrine of illusion is not just a solution of convenience, which justifies bringing everything on the plane of phenomena to a single level. He says that metaphysical synthesis is not a physical leveling out, because there is no true synthesis without discernment. So this description of optical democracy in Blood Meridian is concerned with just such a leveling out. So René Guénon, who's a contemporary of Schuon's, also addresses this concept of leveling out in The Reign of Quantity, which is a work that details the decline of spirituality in the modern world. Guénon writes that unity and uniformity are often mistaken for the same thing, but the imposition of uniformity actually leads in a direction exactly opposite to that of true unity. Guénon explains that uniformity, in order that it may be possible, presupposes beings deprived of all qualities and reduced to nothing more than simple numerical units. The result of all efforts made to realize such uniformity can only be to rob beings more or less completely of their proper qualities. He concludes by stating that all efforts at leveling, such as we witness in Blood Meridian's optical democracy passage, always work downwards, not only below the degree occupied by the most rudimentary of living beings, but also below that occupied by lifeless matter, which is why we get the reference to the rocks. In the end, everything comes down to the level of the rocks in Blood Meridian. So I think what we're witnessing in Blood Meridian is a sort of... In Blood Meridian, we get this kind of satanic parody throughout, that you've got the judge as the 13th member of the gang, you've got the Last Supper there. There's all kinds of satanic inversions, and the judge is a sort of satanic figure himself, and parody is a very important part of the satanic. In the Black Mass, you have the Catholic Mass parodied. So in Blood Meridian, this optical democracy is kind of like a satanic parody of transcendent unity. It's a because human beings are reduced not only to the level of a spider or a blade of grass, but all living things are reduced on the same level as inanimate stones. So the traditional hierarchy of being, which was so important to Western thought since classical times, has been completely obliterated. Now, looking at this passage in the context of McCarthy's entire body of work, which is preoccupied with the sacred, and I think it's very metaphysical and very numinous, I think it's unlikely that this vision of optical democracy constitutes McCarthy's understanding of the world, at least as it's presented in other novels. Now, I'm not going to get into authorial intention too much here because it's a very slippery slope and it doesn't really matter, but I just think it's interesting that he addresses the same theme again in The Sunset Limited, where the character Black states, "I would say that the thing we are talking about is Jesus, but it is Jesus understood as that gold at the bottom of the mine. He couldn't come down here and take the form of a man if that form was not done shaped to accommodate him." Now, the image of the gold at the bottom of the mine occurs in both Buddhist and Gnostic thought, interestingly enough. And in both cases, this is a simile for the divine spark in man. That's from Edward Conder, Further Buddhist Studies, in a chapter where he compares Gnosticism and Buddhism. In Sunset Limited, Black goes on to stress this divine essence within all human beings, even at the cost of sounding like a heretic. And he says, "And if I said that there ain't no way for Jesus to be ever man without ever man being Jesus, then I believe that may be a pretty big heresy. But that's all right. It ain't as big a heresy as saying that a man ain't all that much different from a rock, which is how your view looks to me." So here, man and rock explicitly do not share an unguessed kinship. And even the character White, who is a suicidal rationalist, who pretty much disagrees with Black throughout the play, actually agrees with him at this point and says that, "It's not my view, I believe in the primacy of the intellect." So he agrees with him. He says, yes, man is different from a rock. So whether one considers humanity in spiritual or intellectual terms, the existence of the spirit or the mere presence of consciousness necessarily separates a human being from an inanimate stone. So the vision of optical democracy seems to rise out of these satanic perversities, these inversions that occur throughout the novel in both thought and action. It's part of this depraved world of Blood Meridian. Rather than being a nihilistic pronouncement of the meaninglessness of human existence, it's part of this parodic play that we get throughout the novel. Now, as mentioned earlier, this terrifying void that constitutes the cosmos is a central metaphor throughout the novel. But the horror applies not only to the macrocosm of the solar system, but also to the microcosm of humanity's inner life. So we have this, the secret dark of the Earth's heart is also the awful darkness inside the heart of the human being. There are various atrocities described in vivid detail throughout the book, and I'm not going to get into them here because I'm sure you're all familiar with them. But the point is that human beings are not the only culprits. In Blood Meridian, the natural world is also a devourer. It also senselessly kills and devours everything around it. Towards the end of the novel, the kid encounters a field of slain buffalo, with the meat rotting on the ground and the air whining with flies and the buzzards and ravens, and the night a horror of snarling and feeding, with the wolves half-crazed and wallowing in the carrion. The feeding frenzy recalls a scene from Moby Dick, which McCarthy has listed as one of his favorite novels, where thousands and thousands of sharks swarming around the dead leviathan smackingly feasted on its fatness. Melville's words, "Consider once more the universal cannibalism of the sea, all whose creatures prey upon each other, carrying on eternal war since the world began, may well be extended to cover the wastelands of Blood Meridian." Such a view of nature is markedly Gnostic. As a Manichaean text demonstrates, it is the fate of all living creatures to be cast into all things, to the teeth of panthers and elephants, devoured by them that devour, consumed by them that consume, eaten by the dogs, mingled and bound in all that is, imprisoned in the stench of darkness. The German mystic and theologian Jakob Boehmer, who we've already discussed, that we know McCarthy read Boehmer because he uses the epigraph at the beginning of Blood Meridian, was also dismayed by this brutal aspect of existence and lamented that within all nature there is a continual wrestling, battling, and devouring, so that this world may truly be called a valley of sorrow, full of trouble, persecution, suffering, and labor. Boehmer dealt with this theme at length in his six theosophic points, writing that the essence of the life of darkness, which is actually mentioned in the epigraph to Blood Meridian, is a perpetual stinging and breaking, each form being enemy to the other. This behavior, according to Boehmer, is seen among men and beasts, where there is a biting and hating and striking and an arrogant self-will, each wishing to rule over the other, to kill and devour the other, and elevate itself alone, also to trample upon everything with guile, wrath, malice, and falsehood, and make itself lord. Boehmer's description of the life of darkness reads like a summary of the narrative action within Blood Meridian, and the judge is the supreme manifestation of this life of darkness. This anti-cosmic stance emerges organically out of what Tennyson called nature red in tooth and claw, which is the sort of nature we find throughout Blood Meridian. Blood Meridian demonstrates that not only are the living organisms on this planet subject to an endless cycle of devouring, but that they're also threatened by the hostile forces of nature itself, not just by each other, but nature itself is a devourer. This is made apparent when the men ride past parched beasts that had died with their necks stretched in agony in the sand, and now upright and blind and lurching askew with scraps of blackened leather hanging from the fretwork of their ribs. They leaned with their long mouths howling after the endless tandem suns that passed above them. Again, we've got the sun present in the scene of death. It's as though the very earth demands the blood of creatures. This is a thirsty country, says an old Mennonite early in the novel, a country that has soaked up the blood of 1,000 Christs, and still nothing has changed or ever will change. The world is a great stained altar stone demanding constant blood sacrifice. The Gnostics were not content with simply identifying the manifest world as an evil place, but sought to explain why it was so. And they arrived at the conclusion that the created order cannot be the product of the transcendent God, but must have been created by a lower divine being. In the Gnostic myths, the Demiurge created the cosmos after seeing a reflection of the divine light of the alien God. Sir Hans Jonas writes that it is with the help of the projected image of the divine form that the lower forces make the world of man, i.e. as an imitation of the divine original. Now, of course, we get this in Plato as well. Both Gnostics and Platonists spoke of the created world as a mere shadow of an ideal absolute. It's just that, as Hans Jonas explains, the crucial difference is that the former, the Gnostics, deplore the descent by image reflection as the cause of divine tragedy, whereas the latter, the Platonists, affirm it as a necessary and positive self-expression of the efficacy of the first source. So even though in Platonism the forms here on Earth are an inferior reproduction of the ideal forms, creation itself is a good idea. It's a good thing that that happened, whereas the Gnostics think it's a terrible thing. The Gnostics go as far as to describe the process of creation as an imitation, illicit and blundering, of the divine by the lower powers. But both traditions, Gnostics and Platonists, stress the vertical structure of the scale of unfolding, that is, the downward direction of all metaphysical generation, which therefore cannot be but deterioration. In other words, according to both Gnostics and Platonists, created things are only an inferior imitation of a perfected original source. This idea is hinted at during a strange scene in Blood Meridian, where the life forms, which are prisoners, guards, dogs, mules, and a fat priest, all lightly shimmering in the heat, appear like wonders much reduced, rough likeness thrown up at hearsay after the things themselves had faded. So here McCarthy offers a perspective on reality in which all life forms appear as mere shadows of the things themselves, inferior imitations of an original divine source. If the character of the creator can be judged by the nature of his creation, then the depraved human beings and savagely hostile landscapes of Blood Meridian point to a supremely indifferent or downright malevolent entity. A particularly telling scene within the novel explores the question of divine intervention via a description of the senseless deaths of travelers in the desert. Far out on the desert to the north, dust spouts rose wobbling and augured the earth, and some said they'd heard of pilgrims borne aloft like dervishes in those mindless coils, to be dropped broken and bleeding upon the desert again, and there perhaps to watch the thing that had destroyed them lurch onward like some drunken djinn and resolve itself once more into the elements from which it sprang. The reference to pilgrims, again, immediately places this passage in a religious context, and this is strengthened by the addition of dervishes, a dervish being a Muslim friar who has taken a vow of poverty and austere life, some of whom are known for their fantastic whirling or dancing. Both pilgrim and dervish signify those who have set out in search of God, either through spatial or spiritual journeys, But these seekers in the wilderness in Blood Meridian encounter only a senselessly maleficent force. So despite the apparent mindlessness, the dust spout evokes a sense of hostile agency because it lurches away like a jinn. It's an entity. A jinn, according to Muslim demonology, is an order of spirits lower than the angels, said to have power of appearing in human and animal forms and to exercise supernatural influence over men. And it's noteworthy that in Blood Meridian, the judge himself is described as a great ponderous jinn. So the dust spout may be mindless, but the mindlessness of evil does not detract from its destructive efficacy. The dust spout moves with a certain sinister deliberation. It lurches onwards like a being and then resolves itself into the elements. The dust spout passage also evokes the Book of Job. But unlike the voice of God that speaks out of the whirlwind to Job, McCarthy's narrator reminds us that out of that whirlwind no voice spoke, and the pilgrim lying in his broken bones may cry out, and in his anguish he may rage. But rage at what? This terrible silence does not necessarily point to the non-existence of a creator deity, but might be read as an indication of his completely indifferent nature. The judge asks, if God meant to interfere in the degeneracy of mankind, would he not have done so by now? McCarthy's preoccupation with God's refusal to intercede in the proliferation of evil, whether man-made or natural, is thoroughly Gnostic. The judge's words echo those of the Marquis de Sade, whose God asks, did not the perpetual miseries with which I inundate the universe convince you that I love only disorder, and that to please me one must emulate me? Paraphrasing de Sade's argument, Susan Nyman asks, the alternative to God's absence is his presence. If he should be known by his works, what must we infer about his nature? And I think this is what Blood Meridian is forcing us to ask throughout. If God can be known by his works, then what sort of God is he? Both Gnosticism and Buddhism got out of the problem of theodicy, or the paradox of evil, which I should briefly explain. The idea is that God is omnipotent, omniscient, and benevolent, but evil exists. So that means that he either doesn't want to prevent evil and then he can't be benevolent, or he can't prevent evil and then he can't be omnipotent, or he doesn't know about evil and then he can't be omniscient. So these three things that, you know, God's omniscience, omnipotence, and benevolence, which are stated in the Bible, clash with the presence of evil. And Christianity has never successfully resolved this paradox, though many have put forward all kinds of ideas and, you know, like St. Augustine's idea that evil doesn't actually exist, it's simply a negation of good and or an absence of good. But the Gnostics got and the Buddhists got out of it by eliminating the worship of the creator God. They said that whoever created this world is not really worthy of worship. The Buddhists aren't really interested in a creator God, and the Gnostics say that he's downright malevolent and that there is another source somewhere else, another source of divinity. So both systems teach that suffering lies at the very core of existence, of human existence and animal existence. But both of them are soteriologically focused. That means that both of them have some salvation or escape as their ultimate goal. So both systems offer a resolution. Now, Edward Conder, the Buddhist scholar, explains that for Gnostics and Buddhists, salvation takes place through gnosis or jnana, respectively, both words approximating spiritual insight. Gnosis and jnana are both, they're spiritual wisdom. Conder adds that in both cases, insight into the origination and nature of the world liberates us from it. The Buddhists and the Gnostics arrived at similar conclusions as to what the nature of this world may be. The Buddhist idea of samsara, or maya, teaches that the world in which we live our daily lives is illusory. Samsara is the created world and maya is the illusion. So the idea is that samsara is maya, the created world is illusion. It's a collective nightmare that we're all dreaming at the same time, like the Matrix. The Gnostic Gospel of Truth also states that those who live in the world experience terror and confusion and instability and doubt and division, being caught in many illusions. Furthermore, the Buddha taught his followers that all conditioned things are impermanent. That's one of the most important central Buddhist concepts. And that everything in the manifest cosmos is ever-changing, doomed to destruction, quite unreliable, crumbling away however much we try to hold it. Those are the marks of existence. They're suffering, impermanence, and not self. That you know, the essence of human existence is suffering, impermanence, and that the things that we believe are ourselves are actually not ourselves. We have these false egos that we built up, false layers of self that are actually just delusions. Gnostic texts, such as the Mandi and Ginza, also stress the impermanent aspects of creation, claiming that the world is a thing wholly without substance, in which thou must place no trust. All works pass away, take their end, and are as if they had never been. In both the Buddhist and the Gnostic tradition, insight into the nature of the world involves the realization that earthly existence is characterized by illusion and impermanence. Now, I know it's kind of, the idea is that if there's not self, then what attains nirvana? And if you don't exist, then what is safe? But there's a kind of idea that there is a sort of spark or the Buddha nature that's at the core of existence, that's not yourself, but that's what attains enlightenment. And you get the similar thing in Gnosticism where you have the divine spark, which is not the soul, it's not the body, it's something else. There's a separation between soul and spirit, which has been kind of lost to modern thought, but it was very prevalent in early Christian thought that the soul and the spirit are two separate things, the spirit being higher, the soul being more like the psyche. So impermanence and illusion also constitute the nature of the manifest world as revealed in Blood Meridian. For example, the violent lightning storms that persist throughout the novel illuminate a land of some other order, out there whose true geology was not stone but fear. So this description of a landscape in which fear is more real than stone suggests a nightmare world, nightmarish in the sense that it is grounded in subjective perception rather than objective reality, and is therefore ultimately illusory. Lightning also lights up the blue and barren desert, revealing a demon kingdom summoned up, or a changing land that come the day would leave neither trace nor smoke nor ruin, more than any troubling dream. This demon kingdom or changing land is reminiscent of the way that the Gnostics or Buddhists perceived consensus reality, a collective nightmare born of ignorance and spiritual blindness. Now, the Buddhist Hridaya Prajna Paramita, or the Heart Sutra of the Perfection of Wisdom, teaches that once enlightenment has been attained, everything that we see around us is revealed in its essential emptiness and disappears like an insignificant dream. The Gnostic Gospel of Truth also teaches that the pneumatics, or the enlightened Gnostics, have cast ignorance aside them like sleep, not esteeming it as anything, nor do they esteem its works as solid things either, but they leave them behind like a dream in the night. Hans Jonas explains that the metaphor of sleep serves to discount the sensations of life here as mere illusions and dreams, though nightmarish ones, which we are powerless to control. In Blood Meridian, metaphors of nightmarish sleep or hallucination abound in descriptions such as that of the rising sun, in whose eastern light the fires on the plain faded like an evil dream, and the country lay bare and sparkling in the pure air. Now, that is one of the rare instances where the sun actually does bring illumination, where it's not malevolent. So the sun is ambivalent in Blood Meridian. It does occasionally shift into a positive force. Or we also have the secular aloes blooming like phantasmagoria in a fever land. So there's these fevered visions and evil dreams throughout Blood Meridian. There's many of them, and I can't get into them all. But they emphasize the Gnostic insistence on the fundamental unreality and sinister nature of the manifest world. Because not only are they dreams, they're evil dreams. So Judge Holden seems to articulate this Buddhist Gnostic vision of the illusory and sinister nature of the world when he tells the men, "Had you not seen it all from birth and thereby bled it of its strangeness, it would appear to you for what it is, a hat trick and a medicine show, a fever dream, a trance bepopulated with chimeras having neither analog nor precedent, an itinerant carnival, a migratory tent show whose ultimate destination, after many a pitch in many a muddied field, is unspeakable and calamitous beyond reckoning." Now, these words could have been taken right out of the Buddhist Vajracchedika Prajna Paramita, or the Diamond Sutra of the Perfection of Wisdom, which reads, "A star's a fault of vision as a lamp, a moksha dewdrops or a bubble, a dream a lightning flash or cloud, so should one view what is conditioned." Like the judge's description of the world as a medicine show or carnival, the Diamond Sutra describes the world as a moksha, because like a magical show, it deceives, deludes, and defrauds us, and is false when compared with ultimate reality, or nirvana. The trope of the world as a medicine show, or itinerant carnival, is repeated throughout Blood Meridian. For example, we have a troupe of itinerant magicians described as a set of right wonder folk cast on this evil terrain. The tribe of Yuma, that massacre the Glanton Gang, watch the fire as might some painted troupe of mime folk. Even Judge Holden, who's leading a naked idiot through the desert, seems like he's fleeing from a medicine show. The repeated motive of the migratory tent show emphasizes the Buddhist and Gnostic beliefs that the manifest world is both fraudulent and impermanent. The judge's sermon about the nature of the world seems to draw upon other similes from the Diamond Sutra, and I suspect that McCarthy might be familiar with it because it's too much of a coincidence that he's using these same metaphors. For example, his description of the world as a fever dream echoes the sutra's teachings that the world is like a dream because only the enlightened are awake to reality. Compared with their vision of true reality, our normal experience is that of a dream, unreal and not to be taken seriously. The judge's description of the world as a hallucinatory trance be populated with chimeras. Now, one of the definitions of chimera in the OED is a horrible and fear-inspiring phantasm. And this evokes the sutra's reference to a fault of vision, because the world as it appears to the ignorant is like a hallucination which springs from an eye disease. The judge's description of the world as itinerant and migratory places emphasis on its essential impermanence. So the Diamond Sutra also emphasizes the impermanent nature of existence, comparing the world to a dewdrop because of its evanescence, and a bubble because it can be enjoyed only for a moment before bursting and revealing its inherent emptiness. Elsewhere, the judge claims that this desert upon which so many have been broken is vast, but it is also ultimately empty, hinting at the idea that the manifest cosmos is ultimately a void. Now, emptiness, or shunyata, is a central concept in Buddhism, but this is not the emptiness of the nihilists. It's not the nihilistic void, because shunyata is one of these words that negates its own meaning. It's simultaneously fullness. It's emptiness and fullness. It's emptiness and suchness. It's nothing and everything. It's the whole idea of nirvana or shunyata is non-binary. It's the idea that in our everyday experience, we experience the world through binary language. But once we attain enlightenment, all that slips away and suddenly it's everything and nothing. And this is why it's beyond words, because words are necessary. If something is this, then it's not that. But shunyata tries to break free from this concept by saying that it's a non-binary word. It's nothing and everything. Buddhist sutras teach that all things are empty, the emptiness being this non-binary shunyata. But emptiness means it's an absolute transcendental reality beyond the grasp of intellectual comprehension and verbal expression. I shouldn't even be talking about it because I can't talk about it. Words are binary. It's basically, though Judge Holden does not posit the existence of anything other than a hallucinatory void, he indirectly points to something beyond the supposed illusions of manifest existence. Dreams and hallucinations only lack reality in comparison to the full consciousness we experience in waking life. In other words, there'd be no sense in talking about dreams if we weren't prepared to admit the existence of something other to dreams, some reality that's waking reality. In that case, dreams would be our only reality. So, by the same logic, it makes no sense to talk about the unreality of the manifest cosmos unless we are prepared to admit the existence of an actual reality, a sort of Platonic absolute reality. The Buddhists teach that the world is like a dream, this is a quote from Konza, because just as one perceives the lack of objectivity in the dream pictures after one has woken up, so the lack of objectivity in the perceptions of waking life is perceived by those who have been awakened by the knowledge of true reality. And for the Gnostics and the Buddhists, and for many other mystics, the crown of all endeavor is an attempt to penetrate to the actual reality of things as they are in themselves. And I think this is what McCarthy is getting at with his interview with Gary Wallace when he says that the mystical experience is a direct apprehension of reality. The ultimate reality is defined in both Buddhism and Gnosticism as that which stands completely outside the sensory world of illusions and ignorance. The mystic is a realist, says Evelyn Underhill, who's compiled a great book on mysticism, because a mystic's sole purpose is to strip away all the veils of illusion that obscure the ultimate reality of the absolute. Thus, by comparing the world to a fever dream, the judge is perhaps inadvertently pointing to the existence of an absolute reality that transcends the illusions and deceptions of the manifest cosmos. And this view imbues the anti-cosmic vision within Blood Meridian with a minute fragment of hope or numinosity. Because if the manifest cosmos, as depicted in the novel, is indeed an evil nightmare, then its blood-stained landscapes and frenzied acts of violence are ultimately only the products of an evil dream from which it is possible to eventually awaken. So there's hope in the novel, though very subtle and hidden. And that pretty much concludes my paper.
Thank you.